Hello, how you doing? I'm Craig Parkinson. You are listening to the Two Shot Podcast. Sit yourself down, pop the kettle on. We're going to have a nice old chat. Who's it with this week? I'm going to tell you right now. How the devil are you? I know, it's Saturday. Rise and shine, or just have that lie in, or go for that run, enjoy that breakfast. We are here, do not worry. It's been, you can hear, can't you? Here I'm in a different environment. That is because I have had to fly over to Ireland. Right, let's go back. Craig, do you still have COVID? No, I'm COVID-free, thank you very much. It was just a bit tricky to record a planned guest because the planned guest was coming round to my house in Manchester, and I had to say, please don't come, I'm not allowed to see anybody, and I don't want you getting COVID. So that kind of put the kibosh on last week's episode, so thank you for bearing with. So I tested positive earlier on in the week, which meant it was just a write-off to record, plus I didn't feel brilliant. And then a few days earlier to testing positive, I was offered a job to come and film a new TV show here in Ireland. And then, of course, I tested positive. So I had to speak to my agent and inform the production company, and I'm going, well, maybe they're just going to get somebody else, because this is, once they've locked the schedule down, is it going to be cost effective for them to move everything? Anyway, they were brilliant, absolutely brilliant, very, very kind and sympathetic, and they sort of pushed the schedule for me, which is great news, hence why I'm here in this slightly echoey environment you can hear. And it's just been crazy and busy, which is why you're getting this on a Saturday. It's a very long-winded way to say apologies for not getting it to you on Thursday, but it was just impossible. I was up at 4:30 to get a flight and then had a very busy day with fittings and makeup tests and what have you. You don't need to know about this. It's all very, very boring, isn't it? Anyway, I'll tell you what isn't boring is this week's guest, and it's only the legend. And I'm not, you know, do you know what? People use the word legend. They bandy it about, and it's uncalled for. But with this, I have a true legend that is Les Dennis. No. Yes. Les Dennis. And you know how on this podcast I don't really talk about career. I really wanted to talk about career with Les because, and I talk about it in the opener, in the whole of 5 years of talking to everybody who's been on, I don't think there's anybody that has ticked so many boxes in the arts as Les Dennis. You've got variety, you've got working men's clubs, you've got pantomime, you've got sketch show comedy, you've got double acts, you've got talent shows, you've got musical theatre, you've got going into the soap operas, going into Coronation Street, you've got reality TV shows, you've got opera, you've got the RSC. I mean, you really get a sense of who Les is in this, and he is absolutely, and I don't mean this in a patronising way, fucking adorable. He's sensitive. He's honest. He says himself, you know, he's an open book. And we could have gone on as ever for another hour or so. I mean, he's just a joy and a delight. He's funny. He's got great stories. We touch on influences, Barry Cryer, younger self, starting out in Butlins, talent shows, His partner, his sketch partner, Dustin G, passing away. 15 years on a game show. I mean, just so much. It's brilliant. I'm so pleased he came on. He's, he's a legend. It's Les Dennis. This is the Two Shot Podcast with Les Dennis. Enjoy, and I shall see you at the end. That's amazing that you've managed to swerve it all this time.
Yeah.
Especially when with work as well. So,
well, last year in Hairspray, I mean, everybody was going down with it, you know? So we, I don't know, they call me the Terminator.
Love it. Les, thanks so much for coming on and joining me. I know we had a few technical issues at the beginning. Yeah. We were both trying to meet up, but we're here there now.
We're here now,
and
yeah.
When, because I've been doing this and talking to all sorts of people.
I've been listening. I love it. Years. It's great.
Thank you, man. I really appreciate it. But when I think about you and I think about your career, I'm thinking variety. I'm thinking working men's clubs, sketch show comedy, game show host, acting, musicals, pantomime, reality TV star. I mean, I don't think I've spoken to anybody with such a varied career over the years. And, you know, I only say this because I look back and reflect upon myself. And when I was growing up, growing up in Blackpool, it was all just about acting. That's all I wanted to do. Mainly, I wanted to make people laugh. You know, that's
and
that's
and changed. You were in the variety entertainment mecca of
well,
Britain.
Exactly. You know? Well, and somewhere that you know very well.
Yeah.
So what was the goal or the plan, you know, when you were growing up? Because you can't have had wanted to put all those feathers in your cap being so young, surely.
Well, it was weird because I started being interested in the first place when we used to sit and watch Sunday Night at the London Palladium on a Sunday night. And
which for younger listeners, they won't know what that show is. Could you just sort of expand on that?
It was a live variety show on a Sunday night. First of all, hosted by Bruce Forsyth. Then there was another comedian called Norman Vaughan hosted it. They would have massive American stars, you know. They didn't ever get Frank Sinatra, but they got everybody but Frank Sinatra. Judy Garland came over and had to be talked onto the stage by Jimmy Tarbuck. She was in such a state at that time, bless her. And Sammy Davis Jr. came over. All the big, you know, American crooners. It was a variety show as well that would introduce new comedians and variety acts, speciality acts, jugglers and acrobats and all that, and the Tiller Girls. The Tiller Girls was the dance troupe of the 50s, 60s that would be on Sunday night at the London Palladium. And at the end of the show, everybody would get onto the Revolve at the Palladium, behind one of the letters that said Sunday Night at the Palladium. They'd all be behind one letter and they'd all wave, you know, the Tiller Girls and all the acts and everybody would all be waving. And I would sit and love that and watch it. When Jimmy Tarbuck took over as host, because he was from Liverpool, he had gone to the same school that I'd gone to, that John Lennon had gone to as well, Quarry Bank. And because he was from Liverpool and his dad was a bookie, my dad worked for a bookie. So I thought, oh, maybe this is possible. You know, he came around in the 60s during Beatlemania. He had the same floppy hair, the kind of same kind of sharp suits, but with the little pocket watch in his waistcoat. Floppy haired. Oh, yes, ba-bum. Is that the one? And I would just sit and watch him and love it. So when we then started going to Butlins as a kid, my dad won the pools. When I say won the pools, he won 250 quid on Littlewood's pools, but that was a lot of money then.
And we managed,
we managed to go on our first holiday and carpet the living room and for some unexplained reason buy a cocktail cabinet that stood in the corner. G-Plan, it would be so trendy now. But it just was ended up filled with all the household bills and everything stuffed inside it, and one bottle of Stone's ginger wine. So that we managed to go to Butlin's, and there was a junior talent competition, and I went in for it and didn't get even past the audition and came out and cried. And my mum said, "Don't worry, there's always next year." And I was like, "Next year?" But the next year, I went back and I did an impressions act and came third. So I got my little cup, and then I used to go. We went every year then, and when it came to the adult talent competition at 14, that was the youngest age for the adult competition. I won the heat in Filey against all the older, more established acts, and got a week's holiday at the end. So that was my beginning through Butlin's, and I went down the variety route, but I always, at the back of my mind, wanted to act.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
You're always there.
Well, when I was at school, I was at school with the school plays were really high standard. Jude Kelly, who would later run the South Bank and the West Yorkshire Playhouse, and Clive Barker, the horror writer, who wrote all and directed the Hellraiser movies. And Doug Bradley was in our school, played Pinhead in those movies.
No way.
So we were all in the school plays together, and I got the lead after a couple of years in those. You know, I played Azdak in Brecht's Caucasian Chalk Circle. Mm. I was in a farce with Clive, and then Clive started writing his own plays and we would perform them. And then we started taking them to the Everyman Theatre in Liverpool. When the season had closed, we'd do our plays as a profit share. We made no money, but that time at the Everyman, watching the company that Alan Dosser created there, it was extraordinary. I saw Jonathan Pryce play Richard III as a white-faced clown in a circus ring, and Anthony Sher was Buckingham, and Bernard Hill was Clarence, and you know, and
wow,
Alison Steadman and Julie Walters and Bill Nighy, Matthew Kelly, all these people, Pete Postlethwaite, were at the Everyman at this one time. It was the most amazing thing to watch, and I used to sit there and watch it and think, I really want to do that. And then we went with the school to Stratford, and I saw Twelfth Night with Emrys James as Feste. And I remember going, I'm doing the clubs, but I really want to do that. And so, you know, later I made the conscious decision to try. I had thought about drama school, but I'd already started to earn in the clubs. So I decided I'd think about it later.
Did you feel that you should carry on at the clubs to get to that route? And obviously we'll get to the fact that you did end up at the RSC.
Yeah, yeah.
But was that kind of the plan? You thought, right, you'll hone your craft here in the clubs of variety around sort of Lancashire and then step up?
I think I remember telling Clive that I was not going to go to drama school and that I wanted to be Dave Allen. And he was very upset with me. He thought I should have gone down the drama route and should have gone to, you know, one of the drama schools. And so I had ambitions, I think, to make it in the variety world. I think, you know, it was never about the money and the fame. I just wanted to be good. I wanted to do stuff on telly, and I wanted to do the live theatre shows. And I loved performing, although it went against every bone in my body, because Leslie Heseltine is, which is my real name. Mm. You know, Leslie Heseltine shies away from in parties, but Les Dennis, you know, opens the fridge door and the light comes on, he does 20 minutes. They're two different people, you know, and I think because they're two different people, that's where, you know, my instinct to act, that's what it was about, wanting to become other people. I think as an impressionist, that's what I was doing. I was taking on other people's personas to get laughs.
Mm. To sort of hide behind other people.
Yeah,
So the Les Dennis would step up and the Leslie Heseltine would sort of fade off into the background.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So the early days of Les Dennis was me on stage kind of doing an act as Les Dennis, you know, and then Les Dennis was doing the impressions of all the other people. And then when I was in a double act with Dustin G, that's when I suppose I suddenly realised that I had to connect with somebody else, and I developed my own style with him.
I mean, talk about training. I'm sure back in the days of variety, you're going to be told very quickly by an audience if you're not doing well. I'm sure they wouldn't shy away from telling you. Was there any times when it just completely crumbled and fell apart for you?
Well, the early days in the working men's clubs were hard. Well, the very early days weren't, because, you know, it was always like, oh, he's only young, he's a lad, he's 17, you know. I'd go with my mum to the clubs. She would drive me around. She saw that I wanted to do it, and she wasn't a kind of a stage mum in that sense, but she could see that I wanted to do it, and so she drove me to all these working men's clubs, even though she had a job in a factory, you know, Monday to Friday. Worked at Lucas Aerospace in Liverpool. So she worked really hard to help me. And the early days, you know, they would be like, oh, he's good, yeah, he's good. And then you're as good as your audience or as good as your last performance. And sometimes I'd come off and think, right, well, maybe I should give this up because that was terrible. You know, I had curtains closed on me. I would always stay on. That's the thing. Because, you know, if you got paid off, or if you walked off stage, you got half your money. And I thought, well, no.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you did. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, if a comic walks off stage and things like, no, sorry, I've had enough, they are going to get their money docked. Or they can pay you off if you do your first spot and they go, sorry, lad, you're not what we want. Don't do your second spot. Here's half your money.
Take the money.
Take the money.
Go, just go.
Yeah. So I would stay on, you know, and I can remember being at a club in the Northeast, and it was a men's darts presentation. And I was doing Frank Spencer and Mavis Riley. They were new then. I was doing all my impressions to a guy's audience that probably wanted, you know, a bluer comic, you know, and I emptied the room in 5 minutes, but I just worked to one table and thought, I'll just do my time. And I used to look at the clock and think, you know, I've got an hour, I've got to do an hour. And you go through it, an hour's material in half an hour quite easily if you're not getting any reaction back. But I'd stay on, and then eventually the concert secretary at this club came to the side in his booth. You know those booths that you kind of see, you know, on Wheel Tappers and Shunters clubs where Colin Crumpton had the flat cap and sat in the booth in the corner, you know, give the comic a chance. This guy got on the mic and he said, come off, bonny lad, don't punish yourself. So, I had nights like that. But, you know, then you go back and you have a good night and it's great. And those were, people say it's a great training ground. It is a great training ground, but it makes for quite an aggressive comic, the working men's clubs sometimes. And, you know, when I got into theatre and I realised that, you know, I didn't have to grab the audience in the first 3 minutes because they were there to watch a theatre show. And, you know, I maybe only had a 12-minute spot. 12 minutes on a theatre stage is a good spot. Whereas, you know, in a club, you need half an hour to get them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How was it? You did touch on there about performing a double act with Dustin later on. How easy was it for you to adapt from a solo sort of variety performer to sharing and balancing and listening with another person?
I loved it. I loved him. He was a star already. When I was a rookie comic, I was going around doing those clubs, and I got onto the Russ Abbott Madhouse, and became part of that rep company. You know, that's what we were, because it was sketches, different sketches every week, you know. A Sherlock Holmes, or a, you know, as they called it, a Barrett Holmes sketch, and then a Bond sketch, Basildon Bond, and a Cooperman sketch, and all sorts of different, you know, you had to be the comedy feed to Russ's comedy. But it was, I was, you know, Susie Blake, Sherry Hewson, Michael Barrymore, Jeffrey Holland, Bella Emberg, Dustin, and myself. It was a great little unit, and we were all having to learn a pile of sketches and then go on at the end of the week and record them. So it was a great training for me in that kind of rep training. But Dustin was incredible. He was, as I say, he was a star in the clubs because he, even without television, he had this kind of, His name was accepted in the clubs, word of mouth. He became a star, word of mouth, you know?
Right.
And he was doing impressions of Bowie and all the old rockers and just filling cabaret clubs. And he, when we got on the Madhouse and we started the Vera Mavis, he was the one that said, we should team up, we should become a double. And I was like, really? You're already established. He said, I'd like to do it. So we did it. We did our first panto with Russ Abbott. And on the billing, it said Dustin G in big letters and Les Dennis in little letters. And he went to, we both shared the same manager at that time. He went to Mike Hughes, unbeknown to me. And then Mike Hughes called me and he said, Dustin wants to have me to have a word with you. I thought, oh, what's wrong? And he said that Dustin felt that there should be parity of pay. He was getting double my wages, and he said, we're doing the same job. I want to give Les half of my money, or, you know, balance it up. So he was incredibly jealous. He was incredibly generous.
Yes, yeah.
Generous. and amazingly, oh, just so gifted. And my time with him, when people say, what's the best time you've had in the... And I've had a lot of great work and, you know, worked with Ricky Gervais and I've been to the RSC and everything. But that time with Dustin was just precious and lovely. And he was... He was a wonderful guy, and he died far too early.
Yeah.
Do you remember him? Did you?
I do remember both of you. I was quite young at the time, but I do remember both of your energy.
Right.
The energy
right.
on screen, and he was very twinkly and very yeah. funny, you know. Yeah. There was always quite a nod to the audience through the
yeah,
telly.
Yeah, absolutely. And he could, you know, he could go to the props table and put on a hat, a cowboy hat, turn round and pull a face, and Robert Mitchum was there. Mm. And he would walk forwards and go, I can't do the voice. Or Larry Grayson, he could put on a pair of glasses and put in some teeth. He loved props. He loved all the work of getting the look right. And he would, and Larry Grayson would be there in front of you. He was fantastic, and I miss him to this day.
I mean, it sounded, just you recalling then, it sounded like such a special time for yeah. you as a person, but also as a performer. You're creating this new thing, this double
yeah.
act, this balanced double act that was working, and it was fantastic. So how was it for you as a person when he was, you know, tragically taken far too young?
Yeah, I mean, as you say, it was an amazing time. You know, in 1979, I was the bottom of the bill with Russ Abbott at the North Pier in Blackpool. And then in 1985, Dustin and I were topping the bill for the whole summer, 20 weeks at the North Pier, which was one of the biggest, most prestigious summer seasons in the country.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But he kind of... He knew he was on borrowed time. He had a condition, cardiomyopathy, enlarged heart muscle. And he was, when we opened on that first night in Blackpool, the show was going fantastically well. At the interval, we came off. He said, I don't really feel that well. The doctor came and looked at him and said, you've had a mild heart attack. We need to get you to hospital. He said, not before the end of the show. And he was determined to go back on and finish the show. And then he was in hospital for 3 weeks. And then I had to carry on my own. Vince Hill was our support act, our, you know, special guest star. And I had to go on for those 3 weeks. And then he came back and then we had an amazing series. But he knew he was kind of on borrowed time. But he was a guy who was, he just lived his life, Dustin. I mean, people said to me, you've got to be nursemaid. You've got to make sure that he stops smoking, that he doesn't have a drink. And if I ever came into the dressing room and there was smoke and he was wafting it away, I was like, Dustin, I'm not your nursemaid and I'm not going to be. It's up to you. So he kind of knew what was coming, but he wanted to have that. And it was that final year and we had our big success on telly. And the big series, the best of the lot, the last one we did, the first episode went out and then he collapsed in Southport on New Year's Day and died on the 3rd of January. And then the series was postponed. So it went out posthumously to great reviews. So your question was, how did I cope after that? It was like the rug had been pulled from under me. But I knew that I wanted to carry on and he'd given me some kind of legacy, really. So I did. And Family Fortunes came along really luckily at that time.
Because I was going to say, I was wondering if it was ever proposed to you for somebody else to come in, not necessarily to take his place, but for you and somebody else to become another double act.
Yeah, people did suggest it. And say, oh, you should team up with Gary Wilmot, or you should team up with NJ Harvey, who actually did team up for a short time with a gal called Alan Stewart. They were an impressionist double act. It was an unusual, I mean, most double acts, comedy double acts, were comedians, and sometimes a comedian and a straight man. But we were two impressionists, and that was unusual. So people did suggest it, but I just knew that we wouldn't be able to recreate it. It had happened by accident and the chemistry just worked. So I didn't want to ever do that. You know, I loved getting out and doing my own thing.
Yeah, now we're going into another realm, which is game show host.
Yeah.
So how the hell did Family Fortunes come knocking?
I mean, literally, it was Dustin had died in 86, the beginning, January 86. And then I was then doing kind of went back to supporting Russ in summer seasons and things, and did my own shows as well. But then in 1987, they decided that Family Fortunes was coming back. It had first of all been Bob Monkhouse for, I think, 3 years. Then Max Bygraves had done it, and then it had a rest. And they said, do you want to come and host the show? I was really reluctant at first because I thought, well, I've never done this. I've never talked to the public. I've talked to them from the stage, but I've never interacted in a game show.
And also as you.
As me.
This is going to be you.
As me. And yeah. I'm also thinking Bob Monkhouse, you know, was the master of that show. Max did a good job, but it wasn't really his home. Bob was amazing on that show. I used to, before I was going out to do a club on a Saturday night, before video and all that stuff, so I couldn't record the show, I would stand by the door thinking, let's see if they win the big money, let's see what happens, and then go to work. You know, he was great at building the tension. It's a game show that has a really good end game, and it does have a tension to it. You know, people say it's one of the best, but Pointless is kind of Family Fortunes in reverse. You know, you're looking for the toughest answer instead of the top answer, but it's 100 people surveyed. The guys, Richard and Alexander, have said that to me. But, it came along, and first, if I look back, we recorded 26 shows in 3 weeks, and I thought, I've got to do jokes like Bob does for everybody. And it's not my thing, and it didn't really work, but they kept with me. And, you know, that first series, you've done 26 shows, And it's there. You can't go back and go, right, that doesn't work. Let's change that tomorrow or next week. Yeah. So I feel very lucky that I got through that first series, because it twigged with me that it came organically out of the connection with the people and the silly answers they'd give me. So, yeah, I loved it. It was, I little knew that at that time that it would be 15 years of me hosting that show and being on Saturday night telly for 15 years. People always used to say that you were part of our Saturday night when we were getting ready to go out. We'd be watching Blind Date and Family Fortunes. So thank you. And I love that. I love that I was part of people's Saturday night.
But of course you were, and that's 15 years, and that's peak Saturday night telly, where the ratings for Blind Date and Family Fortunes were huge.
I think at the peak we were getting 16 million, because there were still only, in the late 80s, still only four channels. So, it was incredible, really. Yeah.
So you've now sort of honed your craft as a game show host.
Yeah.
After those 15 years, was it time to jump onto another game show? Was that the next goal? Or was the acting still at the back of your mind? What was your plan after that? Because I'm sure it opened up a lot of doors for you.
Well, what was great for me about Family Fortunes was that it was 3 weeks that we recorded the series in. We'd do three a day. And that would be me set up for telly for 6 months. And then I could go and do other things. And Mike Hughes, who I mentioned, who was my manager with Dustin, he was very much stay in variety. And I was like, I really want to branch out. I'd like to do some acting. And he wasn't very keen. So we parted ways very amicably. And I found an agent, Jan Kennedy, and she had a drama department. And I made the decision to go off and do a play at the Watermill Theatre in Newbury or Oldham Rep. A director called Ewan Smith made that first decision for me. I was walking through Highgate Village and he said, I want you to come read for me for a play. And I was like, really? It's something I've always wanted to do. He said, I think you can do it. So I went and read with him Skylight by David Hare.
Wow, great play, great play.
Great play, And I read that with him, and he and Jill Fraser, who then ran the Watermill, said, yes, let's do this. And I did David Hare's Skylight, myself and Teresa Gallagher. It's kind of like almost a... Apart from the, I can't remember the guy who played the son, my son, in it. Apart from a couple of scenes that bookended with the girl and the son, the centre is this couple, this restaurateur who has gone back to meet his old mistress, and it's a wonderfully dense play. So that was real baptism by fire, people going, Les Dennis doing this. Bill Nighy had done it at the National, I think. Gambon had done it.
But in a way, you've got to remember, you said it yourself there, Les Dennis doing a play. Do you remember when people were saying, Matthew Kelly doing a play?
Yeah.
Do you know, it's
absolutely.
Like... And you did mention about Matthew Kelly before, but obviously there's parallels because Matthew Kelly presented game shows and Stars in Their Eyes for such a long time.
Yeah, absolutely.
But and also you've said to yourself, acting was always there, even from young. It's always been something that you've wanted to do, but it's just about how odd the career paths take us, that we come back round to it.
That we come back, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I quote this a lot, and but The Guardian said when I did Adam's Family, in the long, strange career of Les Dennis, he makes yet another left turn. Now, at first, I was like, oh, that's not very nice. And then I thought, well, wait a minute. It actually does say that, I'm going full circle. So, so it is, I take it as a compliment, that funny review. So, I'm always, Denise Welsh and I are always talking about the fact that we're revelations. Because she's known for Loose Women, when she goes and does a play, and she's great, people go, Revelation, and I get that a lot as well. And I keep getting it. You know, you keep having to prove, you know, to audiences that you, and to critics, that you can do it.
But it's, in a way, you're not even proving to them. You're shocking them.
Yes.
And that, I think that's one of the biggest compliments that you can do. You can shock them and go, wait a minute, because, you know, everybody's sort of constantly going, yeah, but you thought I could do this, but actually, look, this is what I've always kind of wanted to do, and I can do it.
Yeah.
I've been doing a deep dive recently over the past sort of few months on Barry Cryer, and I've always loved and sort of respected Barry and his work. And I was listening to a lot of interviews with him.
And me too. I've been listening.
Aren't they fantastic? And then inevitably, some of the same stories do come up.
Yeah.
But when Barry tells them, or he's telling one of his incredible jokes about a parrot.
Yeah, yeah. And the parrot jokes are incredible, aren't they?
Incredible.
Yeah.
But it's every time, it never fails to make me laugh, because he's laughing and telling this anecdote or this joke like it's the very first time he's ever told it.
He was wonderful and a friend. He worked on with me and Dustin and with Russ, and we had. I was one of the comics that he'd ring on your birthday, you know. And I knew I'd get a call from, you know, Barry on my birthday, or like for instance when I became a dad again at 55, he called me and said, 55, you don't look 55. I bet you did once. He said, it's a great age to be a new dad because you're up three times a night anyway. So I was, last Sunday, I was honoured. Graham Garden called me and asked me if I would host. They did a tribute. Barry Cryer, he should have been at the Slapstick Festival last Sunday.
In Bristol.
Doing his one-man show. And it ended up that it was a tribute to Barry. And I hosted it. And Colin Sell and Graham from I'm sorry, I haven't a clue, and Barry's son, Bob Cryer, who did some wonderful, have you listened to those, the podcasts with?
Yeah, I listened to all of them, yeah.
Well, you know, they were there, and we just reminisced, and we showed clips, and the audience, exactly like you say, even if they knew it, and somebody told the parrot joke, and then somebody in one of the memories told the same parrot joke, and the audience still loved it. They just loved. He had a great twinkly smile, lovely, funny man. You know, he just loved life. Yeah. Bless him.
And also somebody with such a career in comedy, but was a huge, huge supporter of new up and coming comics and stand-ups now. And it always sort of, I always think of the comedy world sometimes as quite a tough, tough world to break into.
Yeah,
but
it is.
I don't know anybody that didn't have time and respect for somebody like Barry Cryer.
Yeah. Yeah, he kind of, everybody across, he didn't think that when I first started, he was like, he was welcome. You know, come in, you're welcome. He didn't worry, he didn't feel threatened by anybody, and loved comedy across all the strands, you know, from alternative, as they call it, you know, new wave, and, you know, the variety guys. Yeah.
Yeah, and not a snob. Not a snob about comedy at all. But love the intricacies of it.
Did you get to meet him?
I did. I got to meet him about 3 years ago.
Okay, great.
And he was talking with Andrew Collins, the journalist, and Andrew said, oh, Craig, come over here. And obviously, Barry was halfway through, obviously, an anecdote to like four other people.
Yeah.
And Andrew Collins went, Craig, come over here, come and meet Baz, come and meet Baz. And Andrew went, Barry says, Craig, love to meet you. So anyway, and carried on with his talk, and it was just like, you're welcome into the story, but I'm holding court now. And it was just brilliant.
Andy Hamilton said that, he said, Barry Cryer's anecdotes hunt in packs.
Les, when you were invited in to the Big Brother house, it was very early on I suppose people were still thinking that Big Brother was this sort of social experiment.
Yeah.
What were your intentions going in? Because it's we'll just talk briefly about what happened in there for people that don't remember. But starting off, it's going to strip it away. You're going to be quite naked going in there because it's hard, isn't it? Because I think if you go into one of those shows, do you put on a performance? Do you just sort of strip everything away? Do you be yourself? What was your thinking behind it?
Well, I think the kind of, for me, if I'm honest, and I'm always honest, it was not about, we're doing it for charity, which everybody said, you know. It was great that it was, I mean, we didn't get paid. It was very early on and before people started getting massive fees for it. It was the first real Endemol celebrity one that they had done one for Comic Relief, if you remember, with Jack D, where Jack D kind of escaped, which was all comedy and Vanessa Feltz and everybody. But it was, and Claire Sweeney, I remember, came out of it really well. And I thought, oh, great. That's like a good way to get a reboot because the phone wasn't ringing that much. Family fortunes had ended. I was going through a lot of stuff in my private life that was, you know, I was being called Les Miserables by the tabloid press. And, you know, my personal life seemed to be all over the papers more than what I was doing. So I thought, well, if I go into that, it might be a reboot. I might get something out of it.
It was a reinvention, is what you were sort of after.
I was looking for.
Let's just before we get into that, Big Brother, you just touched on how the tabloid press were treating you at that time, and from the outside, that seems very cruel to me. Mm-hmm. How did you cope with that?
I think at the time you thought, oh, well, I have asked for this. I am in the public eye. I have to expect the downtime. I think Lenny Henry said to me one time, he said, it's the fame tax. Now, with hindsight and having found out that I was hacked for 9 years, you know, post Levinson inquiry and, you know, and was part of that whole thing of newspapers hacking phones. You know, I disagree with the idea that they should have done it. But, you know, I was going through it. When you're living through something like that, when you wake up in the morning and you look out your window at 6 o'clock in the morning and there are six cars parked across the road with journos in it, you know, until 6 o'clock at night, when you then, you know, I had to, at that time, art imitating life, I was playing Amos Hart in Chicago.
In Chicago, yeah.
Mr. Cellophane. So, and I would get, you know, run out to my mate's car and jump in and he'd get me to the theatre. But as we were leaving my house, there were photographers bouncing off the front of the car, you know, to get a shot. I felt like I'd, you know, committed some massive crime. So when you're going through all that, you know, you just have to live day to day with it, you know. And when I look back, it was just extraordinary. Yeah.
I can't imagine. It's quite a lot to take on because, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, you always come across, you've already said this anyway, very honest, but also quite a sensitive human being.
Yeah, I hope so. You know, I hope
Well, you do. And talking to you now, you know, I think you do. But a very, you know, a very human. You're a human being. You know,
I'm an open book as well to a lot of extent. You know, I don't. I wear my heart on my sleeve, and sometimes you get burnt with that. So yeah, going then into Big Brother, thinking, well, maybe this will be a reinvention, was not necessarily my greatest moment. But if I hadn't done it, you know, Ricky Gervais wouldn't have come calling. And that was the reinvention. But just to illustrate in the Big Brother house and, you know, the editing of stuff, I remember that one day Mark Owen was sitting with his guitar and he was singing, "'Cause the drugs don't work, they just make you worse," singing away with his guitar. And I'm very suggestible. If a song is sung to me, it's in my head all day. And when it went out on TV, the episode, they cut Mark singing out. That didn't make the cut. They just had me at the end of the show as the credits rolled across the bottom in the jacuzzi singing, "'Cause the drugs don't work." They just... So, you know, I was talking to chickens thinking it was comedy shtick, but they were summoning the psychologist. So people thought I was having a breakdown. I don't think I particularly was. Looking back at it, you know, there have been worse. It's a 10-day experiment for us. We were only in for 10 days and there were only 6 of us. So, you know, it was like, it wasn't my best moment. But as I say, Ricky Gervais came calling.
But I can't imagine... I mean, back then, obviously now there's people that are ready to go into such an experiment in a house with six or 10 strangers.
Yeah.
It's not something I would fucking hate it. That would be the worst thing. But when you said about Ricky Gervais calling, and if for anybody that hasn't seen it, obviously do go and watch Les in Extras, which is brilliant, and you are brilliant in it. But did you ever worry... reading that script or what Ricky was telling you about what he wanted you to do, that you were going to be laughed at rather than laughed with?
I think my friends worried about that more than I did. I got the call from Ricky and he said, "Will you come in and meet me and Stephen? We're doing this show." And I'd heard about this extra show and we're interested in you playing a twisted, demented version of yourself. So they were right up front with it. And I was like, "Oh, really?" And they said, "Think Larry Sanders, think Curb Your Enthusiasm." And once they gave me those reference points, you know, because a lot of, well, A-listers, I was not an A-lister, but that a lot of A-listers would kind of lampoon themselves in those shows, and they're brilliant shows. And certainly with Extras, he did have, apart from me, he did have A-listers. He had, you know, Samuel L. Jackson, Kate Winslet, Ben Stiller,
Patrick Stewart.
Yeah. It was incredible. Like when I went in to see them and the board was up there with all the ideas, you know, the cards, you know, when they're coming up with ideas and they put their cards up of, you know, what we'll do in this episode. And they went across there and there's Samuel L. Jackson, there's Kate Winslet, and there's your episode, The Man. And it's all about you and you're in Panto and everything. They told it to me and I went, "Well, great. Yeah, I'm really interested." And they said, "Is there anything we shouldn't do? You know, if," and I said, "Go as far as you like." I said, you know, and as I was walking out and they went, "Oh, we didn't mention the arse scene." I went, "What?" And they said, "You're going to be in the dressing room," and they told me about that. And I went, "Oh, yeah, fine. Do you want an arse double?" I went, no, you won't get one as bad. I'll do it myself. So I went away, and my friends were like, "Ooh, be careful. But, you know, I saw the chance to show that I had a sense of humour about anything. At that time, people were saying Les Dennis is a bit miserable. So I had a chance to go, "I'm not, you know. I've just been walking the dogs and, you know, while I'm picking up poo, I've got a photographer in my face, as I have every day. That's how miserable I am. But I can show that I can laugh."
Which you did.
Yeah.
And you're far from miserable. Les, how did we get to the RSC? And when I say we, I mean you.
Well, you know, I went to the RSC when I was 17 with the school and I saw Emrys James in that wonderful production of Twelfth Night and thought I'd love to do that one day. And I got a call from my niece, Jodie McNee, who, I don't know whether you know Jodie.
I think I just saw Jodie McNee at the Royal Exchange.
You did, yes, ago. Yeah. In she's, Adult House. In,
yeah, she's brilliant.
She is. She's amazing. Yeah. When she was a kid, she used to do impressions and stuff, and she was in a road show, and I did a show called Give Your Mate a Break for ITV, a talent show. And when I went in to meet all the researchers and everybody, they said, we found this girl, this impressionist in Liverpool. She's fantastic. And I thought, that's going to be our Jodie. And I had to declare an interest and say, when they said this girl, Jodie McNee, I said, I couldn't go, you know, host the show and have her there without them knowing it. And they went, oh, that's a problem. We're not going to be able to have her on. So, you know, I was always her mentor as a, you know, as an act. And she started the same way as I did. And then she went to Drama Centre, which I heard you talking to, was it John Sim about, yeah. And she was telling me about that. In fact, she lived at ours in, I was living in Primrose Hill. So she had the best digs of all the students at the Drama Centre.
And one day, she did, yeah.
One day she said to me, Uncle Les, I've got to go out. I need to go and get some Tracky Bottoms and Antigone. She needed a copy of Antigone, which she eventually did one of her first productions at the Nottingham Playhouse. You see how proud I am of her. She's done that route that I wanted to do. And she's done so well. She's been at the RSC, she's been at the National, she's been with Cheek by Jowl, Royal Exchange. I've got to go and catch that before it finishes, A Doll's House. But she's fantastic. And she rang me that year. It was 2018, I think it was, and it was in January. And I didn't have anything. I had snow blindness in my diary. You know what it's like in our business. Sometimes you're busy and sometimes you're not. And she went, Uncle Les... She still talks like that, even though she can do any accent she wants, but she still holds on to her very Scouse roots. She said, our director, Prasanna Puwanaraja, who I think, again, you've talked to.
Yeah, I love him. Yeah, good man.
Prasanna is looking for a Liverpool actor to play me dad in this Thomas Otway tragedy called Venice Preserved. And I went, oh, right. And she went, do you know any? I went, what? I said, what? Can I meet him? She went, would you? I think she didn't want to say, would you be interested in meeting him? Mm. And I went, well, I'd certainly meet him, but, you know, I don't want to get the job just through nepotism because I'm related to you. So I went to meet Prasanna and Philip Breen, who was doing The Provoked Wife, and they said, will you come and do a season? And that was just joy for me, absolutely, to go to the Dirty Duck, even though now they close at 11 o'clock. They don't do a late actor's drink.
What?
They don't.
11 o'clock?
Yeah, and Provoked Wife wasn't coming down till 10 to 11. but to be part of a company, Jonathan Slinger, Caroline Quentin... It was amazing company to be part of. My mate John Hodgkinson and, you know,
Paul Prekop. I love John.
Oh, of course you did. Was it Hangman you did with John?
Yeah, I did Hangman with John, yeah.
Yeah, well, John and I had done a play before we'd done Neville's Island at Birmingham Rep. So, it was a great time to be there and be part of that company. But I still haven't done Shakespeare. That's the thing.
That's one other box to tick. Yeah, yeah. And I'm sure you're going to do that because we haven't even touched upon the fact that you've been at the opera as well.
Yeah.
And when I say been at the opera, I mean actually been on stage at the Opera House.
The English National Opera.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's one more thing that I think you haven't done, and that's you haven't hosted your own podcast.
No, I haven't.
Now, hear me out, Les. Here we go. Les Dennis is Comedy Heroes. Each week, Les sits down with a comedy hero to discuss comic genius.
There would be a great idea. But you heard how we got on starting today, how much of a Luddite I am and how difficult it was for me to connect. But... I would love to do that. You know that.
Yeah, you go. Get a good producer behind you, Les. You'll be flying. I think that's the way to go. I've got one more question for you, yes. Les, because we've got to go.
Yeah.
And I ask this sporadically with people, but I think it's a very important question. I don't think people ask it enough.
Mm-hmm.
Les Dennis, are you happy?
I am very happy. I'm the happiest I've been in my life. I didn't expect. I had a house in that I I did up and I was living in Highgate on my own. And I, you know, thought, what am I doing this for? It's a family house. I've got a family house here and I don't have a family. My grown-up son, Philip, was grown up. So, you know, he stayed with me for a bit. But I was rattling around this lovely family house thinking, oh, sell it. So I sold it. My mate got said, we'll sell it quickly. So I sold it and then kind of thought, well, you know, I don't need it. I'll find a flat. And then I met Claire, my now wife, and, you know, then a family. And I look back at that house and think, that was the house. And that's what we're trying to create now with this. We're trying to create a family house for us. I love having young kids. My son, Tom, was in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory at school playing Mike TV's dad the other night, and I was so proud. And Eleanor was in Little Shop of Horrors in the seniors, and she did well in that. And so I've got this new lease of life, you know. I'm not working at the moment. I was supposed to be doing a musical tour of Fat Friends the musical with Kay Mellor, and it with COVID and everything fell apart. It's been postponed. So
yeah.
But I'm loving being at home, taking the dogs for a walk, and cooking on a Sunday. So yeah, I'm very happy.
Les Dennis, thank you so much for coming on. You're an absolute joy.
Thank you.
Really thrilled. Thanks so much, man. You take care.
Thank you.
Another episode is done. What did I tell you? I mean, he's just a complete joy. And I said that to Les and I meant it. I'm always so grateful when people come on this podcast. Yeah, that's for one. But when people come on and your thoughts about what they will be like and hopefully what the conversation will be like ring true, and this was one of them. Les is somebody I grew up with watching on telly, and he's quite a perfect guest. He's got so many stories, he's led such a life, and I'm really grateful he came on. I really hope you enjoyed it. I hope for certain younger listeners it was interesting. You got a sort of hark back to the clubs of variety, whether, see, and there are lots of people that listen to this that don't live in the UK. I hope you got a sense of the sticky carpet, smoke-filled rooms of working men's clubs with all sorts of variety shows on, from comedians to singers to impressionists to magicians. Those days are long gone, but it's nice to look back. So a massive thank you to Les, whose house, he's got lots of building going on, so I'm glad he spared an hour or so. If you follow us and support us on Patreon, some of his answers, or most of his answers, all of his answers to the brilliant quickfire lightning round questions this week are spectacular. So go over to patreon.com/twoshotpod, and if you can support us, and that's great. Now, speaking of supporting us, I'm not going to tell you, because we've got a couple of weeks left before we finish this season, and on the last episode I'm going to tell you about some extremely cool, and I mean that, very cool and exciting stuff that's going to be for you. It's going to be for you. If you support us, oh, your days are coming. Trust me, there's something coming for you. If you want to support us, just maybe save your money, because I think you'll be wanting to support your free podcast that you get every single week with some fantastic guests. Speaking of fantastic guests, the last couple of weeks, I'm hoping that there's going to be a little theme, a television theme, an Irish theme, a comedy theme. Can I say anything else? No, I can't. But here's hoping. So what else have I got to tell you? A massive round of applause to all our TSP guests who have been on over the years, who have been nominated for BAFTAs this year. I'm talking about Jodie Comer, I'm talking about Mark Mundon. I'm going to miss loads of people. Kelly Lee Llewellyn. Sorry, I'm thinking and talking at the same time. Joseph Gilgan. Sanjeev Bhaskar and Unforgotten. Yeah, loads. Brilliant. Immensely proud of everybody who has been nominated and has been on this show. So if you like, go back and listen to their episodes because they're great. And certainly people like Joe and Jody, Mark Mundon, they don't go on other people's podcasts. They just come on ours, which is the way I like it, to be honest, because then you don't get the same old stories, the same old anecdotes, the same old conversations. That's what we try and pride ourselves here. And that's why you support us and you come in weekend, week out, weekend. Well, that's fitting, isn't it? Because it's Saturday. But next week we will be back to normal on a Thursday. Just got to get the guest. Oh, wait a minute. I think I know. Yeah, I'm not going to tell you because it's going to be an absolute beaut. Until then, enjoy the rest of your weekend. I'm going to explore Dublin and get to know it and fall in love with it. So until next week, thank you so much for downloading and subscribing and telling your friends and reaching out on social media and emails and supporting us on Patreon. It really, really does mean the world. I am going to stop now and go. I appreciate you. Take care. Until next week, I've been Craig Parkinson. He's been producer Griff. And this has been the Two Shot Podcast. You take care. The Two Shot Podcast is presented by me, Craig Parkinson, recorded and produced by Thomas Griffin for Splicing Block. Our music, our brilliant music, is courtesy of Then Thickens. Cheers.